Face the Nation, coming up next.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
Today on Face the Nation, the year 2015 winds down, and we'll take a look at what's ahead in 2016.
There's a tornado in front of us.
Severe storms in Texas and the southeast have claimed at least 28 lives this weekend. Temperatures could reach record highs in other parts of the country. We'll have the latest. And it's been the year of the outsider, and we'll talk to two outsider candidates, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former neurosurgeon Ben Carson. As the voting in Iowa gets closer, what kind of course are they charting for victory? Then, a rare interview with the host of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
Stephen, I want to know...
Talk to them, excuse me. I'm having an intimate moment with Sunday morning people. Hi. Is this Sunday?
It's Sunday.
Then it must be Face the Nation.
We'll get his thoughts on politics and the presidential campaign.
I'm looking for a theory of this election. Do you have one?
Anything goes, I guess. All bets are off.
Plus, we'll go out of this world for another rare interview.
Station, this is Face the Nation. How do you hear me?
I have you loud and clear. Welcome aboard the space station.
NASA Commander Scott Kelly joins us from space to talk about what it's like to have the Earth spinning outside of your window every day. It's all ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. Last night, tornadoes killed 11 people in Texas, bringing the death toll due to severe weather on this holiday weekend to at least 28. CBS News correspondent Mark Strassman is in Holly Springs, Mississippi for us this morning. Mark?
Good morning, John. Those twisters in Texas capped a Christmas week of violent storm systems that spawned tornadoes across the South. At least 11 tornadoes were reported in areas around Dallas overnight in bedroom communities northeast of the city like Garland. The day's first light has shown the scope of the damage. In Garland alone, 8 people were killed. It has 600 damaged homes and a disaster zone of 2 square miles, and the tornado ran for 40 miles. Since last Wednesday, tumultuous weather and record rainfalls have been a way of life in the South. 10 people were killed in Mississippi. Roughly 250 homes were destroyed or have major damage. The most severe tornado ran for 145 miles with winds of 160 miles per hour. Tennessee had 6 deaths. People were also killed in Arkansas and Alabama, and flash flooding is an ongoing worry. I met one storm victim here in Mississippi named Kenya Williams. 6 of her neighbors were killed. 6. When the tornado hit her neighborhood, her elderly, handicapped, and blind father was alone in the house. The roof and the walls collapsed on top of him, but he survived with nothing worse than a bump on his head. Kenya has to rebuild her home and her life from the slab up, but she's content with that. John?
Mark Strassman, thanks. We turn now to presidential politics. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders joins us from Burlington. Good morning, Senator. This year, as we look back, you and Donald Trump are the big surprise political stories. You've suggested recently that your message about the economic inequality can appeal to the Trump voters. Explain how that happens.
Look, many of Trump's supporters are working class people, and they are angry. And they are angry because they're working longer hours for lower wages. They're angry because their jobs have left this country and gone to China or other low-wage countries. They're angry because they can't afford to send their kids to college or they can't retire with dignity. And I think what Trump has done successfully, I would say, is take that anger, take that anxiety about terrorism, and say to a lot of people in this country, look, the reason for our problems is because of Mexicans. And he says they're all criminals and rapists. We got to hate Mexicans. Or he says about the Muslims, you know, they're all terrorists and we got to keep them out of this country. That's what we have to deal with to make America great. Meanwhile, interestingly enough, John, this is a guy who does not want to raise the minimum wage. In fact, he has said that he thinks wages in America are too high. But he does want to give hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the top 0.3%. So I think for his working class and middle class support, I think we can make the case that if we really want to address the issues that people are concerned about, why the middle class is disappearing, massive income and wealth inequality in this country, that we need policies that bring us together, that take on the greed of Wall Street, the greed of corporate America, and create a middle class that works for all of us rather than an economy that works just for a few.
But, Senator, essentially you're saying that people should be concerned about what you're talking about, not what Donald Trump is talking about.
Well, not really, John. I mean, everybody is concerned about the disappearing middle class, the fact that we have 47 million people living in poverty, that we're the only major country on earth that doesn't provide paid family and medical leave or guarantee health care to all people. People are very worried about how they're going to retire with dignity. And that's why I believe we need to expand Social Security benefits. Those are the issues that are on most working people's minds. And what I'm suggesting is that what Trump has done with some success is taken that anger, taken that those fears, which are legitimate, and converted them to be into anger against Mexicans, anger against Muslims. And in my view, that is not the way we're going to address the major problems facing our country. The way we address them is we bring our people together. We demand that Congress passes legislation which creates millions of decent-paying jobs, raises the minimum wage, pay equity for women, making college affordable for all. And those are the ways, I think, that we improve lives for our people, not by dividing us up and having us hate Mexicans or Muslims.
Let me switch to the issue of Sandra Bland. The grand jury in Texas decided that no felony was committed by the sheriff's office or jailers in connection with her death. And you said afterward, quote, "There's no doubt in my mind that she, like too many African Americans who die in police custody, would be alive today if she were a white woman." What did you mean?
I saw that tape, John. I don't know if you did, but I saw the way the police officer behaved toward her. It is my very strong inclination that if she was a white middle-class woman, that would not have happened. But it's not just in Texas. I mean, what we have seen is far too many people, often African-Americans, who are unarmed, getting shot and killed by police officers. We need, in my view, very significant criminal justice reform. We need to make sure that lethal force. Now, being a cop is a very difficult job, and I was a mayor for 8 years. I work with police officers. Most of them do a really good job. But we need to be clear that lethal force, killing people, should be a last option, not a first option.
But, Senator, I'm sorry.
We need to make...
To interrupt, I apologize. But in this case, there was no lethal force used against her. You're not saying that her death was committed by the officers in this case, are you?
No, of course not. But she was yanked out of that car, thrown to the ground, confronted by the police officer. She responded, and she ended up in jail, and 3 days later, she was dead. The way she was yanked out of that car and the way she was treated by that police officer is not something that I think would have happened to the average middle-class white woman.
Right. Okay. Let's switch to politics here. I was talking to a Democratic strategist who said that, looking at your campaign, he said that you needed to attack Hillary Clinton at least as much as Senator Obama did in 2008. You said you won't do that. Is that going to be something that gets in your way in your ability to get the nomination if you don't attack in that way?
Do I have to wage horrible attacks against Hillary Clinton? No, I'm not going to do that. But what I will do is contrast our ideas and my record with Hillary Clinton. That's what elections are about, and that's what people want to hear. I voted against the war in Iraq. Hillary Clinton voted for it. We have different views on foreign policy. I do not believe in a situation in Syria, no-fly zone, which I think can get us into a real quagmire. I believe in a coalition led by Muslim troops on the ground with the support of the major powers on earth. I do not want to see the United States getting involved in perpetual warfare in the Middle East. I helped lead the effort when I was in the House against the deregulation of Wall Street. I believe that Wall Street's greed and illegal behavior has been a disaster for this country, not only back in 2008, but it remains. You got to break up these large financial institutions, reestablish Glass-Steagall. Those are differences of opinion that need to be debated.
All right, Senator Sanders, we're going to have to leave it there. We'll look forward to seeing you in the new year.
Okay, thank you very much.
We turn now to the Republican field. Retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson joins us from West Palm Beach. Pardon me, Dr. Carson, I wanted to see if we could pick up on something that Bernie Sanders said there about the Sandra Bland case. What's your take on it? He said that that her situation shows that an African-American is treated so differently by the police than if she were a white woman. What's your reaction to that?
There is no question that, you know, we need to be looking at those kinds of issues. But I think we also have a tendency to inject race into everything. Any time that there are people of different races involved in a conflict. Are there rotten police officers? Of course there are. Just like there are rotten lawyers and rotten doctors and rotten teachers and rotten journalists. But we don't condemn the whole class for that. Having said that, there's no question that we need to be looking at some of the various things that are going on in the Justice Department to make it more sensitive to people. You know, for instance, you know, somebody gets a moving violation, they got a minimum wage job, you know, they're barely making it. That thing costs like $170. They don't have any way of paying that. They ignore it. The next thing you know, there's a warrant for their arrest. They lose their job. You know, all we have to do is be a little sensitive and say, look, you can pay this off at $5 a week. You know, these are the kinds of things that I think will make a difference in our society.
But sensitive to class and economic situation, not to race.
Right. A lot of things that are class and economics are ascribed to race, no question.
Let me ask you about your campaign. There have been some stories this week about its health and the quoted, you talked to the Associated Press. Speaking of your staff, you said everything is on the table. I'm looking carefully. What did you mean by that?
I mean, I want to make sure that we're doing everything that we can do to make sure that the American people absolutely recognize the choice that they have. And if there are some things that need to be changed or tweaked, we certainly are going to be open to doing those things.
Armstrong Williams, who's a close associate of yours, was quoted as saying, Dr. Carson is back in charge, and I'm so happy to see that. What does that mean?
I think you're going to have to ask Armstrong.
So you were always in charge.
I prefer he speak for himself, and I'll speak for myself.
So any changes to your campaign that are coming?
There will be some alterations. You know, we've been looking in every particular area. One thing I want to do is have a much more robust response to attacks, particularly when they are false. And, you know, we've kind of taken a nonchalant attitude toward that. I think that's the wrong thing to do. So you'll see much more aggressiveness in that region.
Since we're looking back at 2015, any attacks that you let go by that you'd like to correct here from the last year?
Oh, there are a lot of attacks. You know, the attacks that, you know, I really didn't have a temper. I guess that's kind of flattering. They said you couldn't possibly have been like that. And then when the articles were found with interviews from my mother and other people, nobody came back and said, oh, we found the evidence. You know, with the West Point story, you know, nobody indicated that, in fact, General Westmoreland was there in February for Congressional Medal of Honor dinner, which is what I said. There was a question about the dates, but you know, no one comes back and corrects any of that. You know, virtually everything that was said, no one comes back and says none of that stuff is true. And I just think we have to probably be the ones who forcefully inject that into the narrative. But also, you know, the narrative that I don't know anything about foreign policy. If you go back and you look at the things that I've been saying about foreign policy over the last year, you'll see that they're the very things that everybody else is talking about now. And right now, you know, I'm talking about the fact that we cannot be distracted by Iraq and Syria only. We need to recognize what's going on in Libya. Libya represents an incredible caliphate for them. It has a lot of oil, and you go north across the water, you're into southern Europe. You go south, you're into Chad and Sudan, Niger, you know.
One of the points you're making, Dr. Carson, is that you've said don't mistake being soft-spoken for not being strong. Do you think in this campaign so far there's been an overemphasis on demonstrations of faith, talking about bombing the bleep out of ISIS and talking about carpet bombing ISIS? Has there been too much of an emphasis on the showiness of strength?
Well, you know, I understand why that appeals to people, because they feel that we've been, you know, feckless and spineless, and that, you know, they want to see, come on now, let's get in there and let's do something. I understand that completely, but I hope people will not be fooled by just, you know, loud speech and gesticulations. I hope people will actually look at what has happened in a person's life, because that's a much better indicator of their strength. What have they overcome? What have they been able to accomplish? And if they will look at that in my life and they look at that in many of the other lives, I think that will make a pretty powerful argument.
You said recently you might be a one-term president. What did you mean by that?
I meant that I'm not in this for political reasons. I'm in this to fix the system. You know, the American people deserve better. And I would do the things that are necessary. We, you know, we have 4.1 million federal employees. That's way too many. We have 645 federal agencies and sub-agencies. Way too many. We're spending money that we don't have. We're destroying the quality of life for the next generation. We cannot do that. And we don't even say anything about it. It's craziness.
Final question here. When the primaries are over, when you look back at this year and how next year will go, when the primaries are over, do you think the Republicans will have picked somebody who is the most popular, or will have picked the person with the best solutions for the country?
Well, I actually think that when it comes down to actually making a choice, the people are going to be level-headed, they're going to carefully consider their options, and I do believe they're going to make the right choice. I'm hoping and praying that that is exactly what will happen, that we will not be attracted to the shiny object in the room, but we will look at what is going to actually solve our problems, because they are substantial. Our country is on the precipice. It's about to go over the edge.
All right, Dr. Carson, we'll look forward to speaking with you in the new year. Happy New Year. We'll be back in a
minute. Thank you. You too, John.
You're a small to mid-sized business with 300 to 3,000 employees. You face the same network security challenges as big businesses do, but can't support a big IT investment, leaving your doors open to advanced cyber threats. Barracuda Next Generation Firewalls provide all the core features of enterprise firewalls and UTMs, but without hidden costs and deployment hurdles, making owning a big business firewall no big deal for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Next Gen Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/firewalls.
There was a lot of news in 2015, and we had a little news of our own here at CBS. Bob Schieffer stepped down from Face the Nation, and CBS's The Late Show with David Letterman became The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. I sat down recently with Stephen to compare notes on navigating such an action-packed year. Stephen, I want to know...
I'm talking to them, excuse me. I'm having an intimate moment with Sunday morning people. Hi. Is this Sunday?
It's Sunday.
Then it must be Face the Nation.
Well done. I'm looking for a theory of this election. Do you have one?
Anything goes, I guess. All bets are off. There's a populism to Trump that I find very appealing. And it's only this, is that the party elders would like him to go away. But the people have decided that he's not going to.
So you like that? The
Yeah, I may disagree with anything that he's saying and think that his proposals are a little, more than a little shocking. But there is something really hopeful about the fact that, 36% of the likely voters want him, so the people in the machine don't get to say otherwise. I that's the one saving grace, I think, of his candidacy.
You have to look at this mess of an election and... like, make something of it, make a joke of it, come to terms with it. Like, how would you feel bad.
I feel bad for the candidates now, you know, because what did we start off with? Something like 22 at one point?
We're still
That's
behind
why
double
we digits. Did Hungry for Power Games, because we were trying to think, of how do we talk about them? Because most of them we know are just going to fall by the wayside, if not literally with an arrow in their chest, but it was certainly massive, you know, campaign debt. You know, God knows what's going to happen to George Pataki. He's going to be swept into the turbines of this election, you know, or tossed over a railing into a pit full of piranhas. Something, you know, bad is going to happen to all the lower tier candidates. And I started feeling bad about how excited I was about each of them dropping out.
What's your view about the facts?
Facts?
Facts and their salience in the conversation.
I'm a big fan of facts. I'm not sure they have any bearing on what person's popularity is, because Donald Trump is like, I'm not the first person to say this, but I completely agree that he's my old character with $10 billion. You know, he's completely playing on an emotional level, and so beautifully. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I just can't do that old character anymore, because he's doing it better than I ever could, because he's willing to drink his own Kool-Aid and manufacture it and distribute it, because he's got all the cash. He's this very interesting, like, Frankenstein of the idea that facts don't matter and only money does, because if money is speech, he's got a $10 billion mouth, and it doesn't have to spend any of it, because everyone will point a camera at him.
Before you started the show, you said you were just hoping he would stay in the race long enough for
you to
start the show.
I really didn't think he'd be doing this well, because I don't really know anything about politics. I mean, as a spoiler, I just pretended for years to know something about it. I know something about human behavior, because I'm really just an actor and a writer.
But you also have a big heart, and you want good stuff to come out of the process.
Oh, yeah, no joke. No joke for Donald Trump or anything, or no joke for any individual candidate means more to me than what I think is best for the country.
If the process looks cynical to you, as it sometimes can, do you ever think, like, hey, maybe we can reintroduce people to, like, what's good about this?
I respect people who are politically engaged, because so few people are. And whatever candidate they support, I respect that. For so many years, I lived on, I pretended to be an advocate for a side. And as such, I always had to take sides. This person is good, that person is bad, and there is nothing in between. I think that area in between is where most people live, but we're asked to go in one direction or the other, mostly so one side or the other can raise money, or one side or the other doesn't have to necessarily explain themselves, and it can be purely on an emotional appeal. But boy, it would be lovely if we all could have a conversation that does not involve demonizing the other side. I think that's worth doing. I don't know if it's my job, but I would say that that's certainly an objective of mine. I've tried to be very respectful to Donald Trump. The first thing I did was apologize to him. I didn't let my audience get mad at Ted Cruz or boo him. I wanted Kasich to have a good time. I hope all the candidates will come on.
Well, there sounded like there was a little bit of Trump respect in you for his ability to channel the populist.
Well, I mean, I have a respect for Trump for knowing who the real audience is, that if you really want to win, you've got to get the people. The people get to make the call, especially now, because the parties are so beholden to big money that the party apparatus itself has been dismantled in favor of just cash. And so there aren't, wise old people who get to make the call, because that's been farmed out to super PACs, which don't seem to be that powerful themselves, really. But in giving the power over to those super PACs, they've actually completely defanged the party themselves. That's why you can't stop a Trump. I mean, that's a real blowback to the idea that we're going to take power away from the party and just give it to cash. What I do respect is that he knows that it is an emotional appeal, and it might be emotional appeals that can't respect, but he knows that you have to appeal to the voter. And that's why I may be wrong. I made a big deal about there's no way he's going to win.
You weren't the only one.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know anything about politics.
Yeah, but you do know about the country. You have a sense of where the country is. You have a sense, and I wonder how you get that now. I mean, you know,
that's one of the reasons I stopped the old show, is that I had a sense where the country is. I think people don't really want constant divisiveness. I really don't think they want that, and that's what I was aping. And I thought, I can't drink that cup anymore, because I don't think people really want to hear it.
We'll have a lot more of our interview with Stephen Colbert coming up. Stay with us. We have more Stephen Colbert ahead. And to see the full interview, visit us at facethenation.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram at @facethenation.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda web app firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. Here's more of our interview with Stephen Colbert.
Have you learned how to interview differently now than what you did in the past?
Absolutely, absolutely. I used to live by the Joe Scarborough rule, which was if someone on your show talks for more than 7 seconds, you've lost control of your show.
Just constantly interrupting.
Now I lay back and just see what they'll say.
And what about the questions you ask?
It's based more on curiosity. I was always in attack mode before. You know, and people want me to attack people still. Like, people were very upset. Like, liberals got so mad at me. Somebody called me, like, a craven sellout for not attacking Donald Trump. I'm like, what? What do you want? What do you want? There's no pleasing some people. Yeah.
Looking back at this year, what I was struck by is after San Bernardino, you started one segment. And you said, I'm trying to manage the tonal shift.
Yeah.
That's what strikes me, is that we have, politics is crazy, but also we've had Charleston, the shooting in Charleston, we've had San Bernardino, the attacks in Paris. We're ending the year in a kind of a fragile, walking on eggshells kind of time.
And I have a responsibility to do a comedy show. It's like a sort of water cooler conversation. And that's why it's not always political or even really news, it's just what people are talking about. And I feel like it's dishonest if I don't attempt to do that, especially if there's an absolute tsunami or just something that eclipses any other thought.
It seems to me a difference between a question and an answer you get and a moment you have.
I love learning new things. We had Michelle Dorrance on, who was a MacArthur Genius Award winner for tap dance. And she said, would you like to learn something? I said, absolutely. I've always wanted to learn to tap dance, never had a chance. And she just taught me, like, what's it called? Half of a shim sham. I don't know that, if I'm still saying that right.
Yeah, I like that with a little orange.
Exactly. It's beautiful. In the summertime, amazing. So refreshing. I have a summer shim sham. Incredible. So that was an amazing joy.
And it was a moment. It wasn't you posed a great question.
I started off as an improviser in Chicago. And so, to me, I learned, and this is what I really enjoy, is I like discovery more than invention. Any discovery I can make is always going to be superior to an invention. Because discovery, you don't know what you're going to find. Whereas invention, you're just presenting to the audience something you've already made. Discovery is always superior to invention.
Was the moment...
I hope you're carving this stuff down in stone, by the way. I feel like I'm comedy Moses on the mountaintop right now. This is good stuff.
This is high quality.
This
is really...
You know what I charge to teach this at the Learning Annex?
Your interview with Joe Biden, was that a discovery in a sense?
After he left, I thought, oh, that nice man just gave me my show. Because I had to be myself in order to receive it. I had no other choice. And it was only my third show. It was such an honor. I was completely moved by his willingness to share that with the audience.
A guy in the back yells, Major Bo Biden, Bronze Star, sir, server them in Iraq. And all of a sudden, I lost it.
It's one of them. I don't want to say the word happy because it's not a happy subject, but in some ways, one of the most sublime moments I've ever had on stage was to be there and to have the ability or to have the responsibility and the privilege to receive that from him.
Yeah, a pretty deep human connection.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere. I mean,
no, I
created
met him,
it in the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
What would you have asked the Pope?
I would have asked the Pope about joy. You know, we call the show the Joy Machine. And because unless you do it with joy, it's just a machine. And less than, you know, 5 nights a week, it'll grind you up and spit you out. And there have been nights. But I would have asked him about joy and where he finds his joy. Like, how did he become St. Peter? How did he get into the shoes of the fisherman without becoming dogmatically so rigid that there is no joy left in him? Because I'm sure Benedict is a nice guy, but you didn't get a real hit of joy off of him. There's no contact high with Pope Benedict. But Francis just exudes a sense that the spirit of the gospel is in him, as opposed to the abstract interpretation that gets activated into dogma, which is really law.
What's next year going to be like? Not for the show, for the country.
It's hard for me to remember when we're not in election year what an election year is like. It's the greatest story you could possibly talk about because everybody cares and nobody gets hurt. You know, nobody dies. It's not a tragedy. It's just super important. That's why I love the election year. You don't have to explain anything to your audience. You can just go straight to the joke because they understand. You don't have to educate them in any way. What's next year going to be like? I don't know. If this year's any indication, I hope it gets better. This was a sad year.
Dark.
Really a dark year. Yeah.
We need somewhere to go for joy.
Star Wars.
What are your feelings about that?
I am thrilled. I think there's something so hopeful about reawakening the idea of the Force. Because the Force is the idea that it binds us together. It doesn't divide us. And you know who the good guys are, and you know who the bad guys are. And isn't that nice in a world where it's sometimes hard to tell? I mean, in some ways, it feels like it's a great time for a movie like that. The same way after 9/11, it was a very good time to have Lord of the Rings movies. Because there was clarity in our culture. There was a cultural artifact that had moral clarity. You know, I do comedy for a living, though. I just want to be clear. I do comedy for a living. This is like the serious, most serious interview I have done
I'm a downer. But it's...
You're not a downer. You're not a downer.
You know, the other thing about comedy, though, is we need to acknowledge this horrible thing that happened. We also need the catharsis of the comedy to get us back on the road to controlling what seems like a time of total chaos.
You can't laugh and be afraid at the same time. And so it's like physiologically impossible to laugh and be afraid at the same time. So I'm very grateful for my job because we think about things like the things we're talking about, but at the end of the day, we have to end up, find some way to laugh about it that is not disrespectful of people's experience of it. And that's an odd little balance to walk, but hopefully we do it sometimes.
Joining us now is the president and editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, James Bennett. Ben Domenech is the publisher of The Federalist. Gene Cummings is political editor at The Wall Street Journal. And David Rode writes for Reuters. I want to start, we're going to look back at 2015 and we're going to go on to 2016. So, Ben, I want to start with you. What in 2015 either surprised you the most or did you find the most interesting?
I was surprised the most by how quickly we saw the arguments about free speech become essentially a monopartisan affair. Civil liberties, I think, in America, the conversation about them has largely been a bipartisan one historically. But in the conversation that we saw take place on America's campuses and in our political fray, I think political correctness is now something that has moved over entirely into a conversation on the right. That surprised me to a great degree. The thing that I found most interesting, though, was actually something that Stephen Colbert made reference to in that interview that you had with him, which was the surprise of the Trump phenomenon. This is a significant one. I think it's politically significant in a way that a lot of people didn't expect. People expected a celebrity campaign. I think, actually, that there's something to be said for finding the good in the Trump phenomenon. He does express, to a certain degree, a degree of Jacksonian populism that has always been a part of American politics and that I think represents a group of disaffected Americans who basically are standing up and saying the status quo is not acceptable, that they want dramatic change.
What surprised you, Gene, this last year?
What surprised me was the collapse of the Republican Party's establishment class. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the rise of Trump, because they've had candidates like Trump, you know, kind of the outsider candidates come and go, but they can't coalesce in the establishment lane. And it's not just in the presidential campaign. It's the entire House leadership collapsed during this past year because of the push from the outside. And that really surprised me because they've been top down for decades.
Yeah, that's the other side of what Ben's talking about. We keep talking about a grassroots lane and an establishment lane. I'm starting to think that the establishment lane is like a bike lane. It's very small. The other lane is a lot bigger. James, what's your feeling about 2015?
Yeah, I mean, I would go with NASA finding running water on Mars, but after that I'd have to say Donald Trump and this class warfare really within the Republican Party. The base revolting against the donor class on the core issues that have stood for, that the Republican Party has stood for cycle after cycle, tax cuts, budget cuts, deregulation, free trade. Donald Trump is challenging party orthodoxy on all those issues, and it's working for him.
Yeah, so it's not just you have a
a kind of shiny object candidate. He's illuminating something big,
yeah.
That's big blocks that are moving. David, what about you?
This is a little sort of less positive, but it is Trump related, but it's the breadth of the fear of Muslims in this country and the sort of acceptance of open bigotry. We wouldn't have said, you know, it would have been completely unacceptable for someone to say in 2012 a Mormon cannot be the president of the United States. So to have major candidates saying a Muslim can't be the president,
there really wasn't
that much of an uproar. I mean, if he had said a radical Muslim, an extremist Muslim, that's absolutely fine. But it's the demagoguery and the tripling and attacks against Muslims. I didn't expect it to get so powerful so quickly, you know, this many years after 9/11.
I feel like, though, that does speak a little bit to, when it comes to Trump's character, his ability to know how to manipulate. He knows how to manipulate a crowd. He knows human folly like the back of his hand, and he knows how to respond to it. But I also think that it speaks to something more significant in the sense that we see this broad-based populist revolt in Europe that comes from both right and left. And I think that we see that echoed in America to a degree that we have not seen historically. And that's something that I think should concern both parties. You saw Bernie Sanders saying earlier that he feels like he can appeal to Trump voters. There is something to that.
Well, and it was striking in your conversation with Bernie Sanders when he talked about the overlap with Trump, how many times he repeated the word anger or angry, that's where the Venn diagram really overlaps for him, and specifically on issues of economic populism and so forth. But it runs counter to something that Stephen Colbert just said, which he thinks Americans are tired of divisiveness.
I was heartened, though, by the very strong pushback by leadership in both parties to the Muslim ban proposal. I mean, to have Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, Hillary Clinton, you know, there was very strong pushback on that. And I think for the Muslim community, that had to have been at least somewhat heartening.
Yeah, although you still see in the polls that there's still support for it within the Republican Party, and Donald Trump certainly didn't seem to fall from that. Let's switch now to 2016, although playing with all of the same themes, basically. Yeah. David, to you, is there a big question in 2016 that you hope will get resolved, or at least a question we should keep in mind as we're looking at issues in the next year?
It's who wins. We've all talked about this. It's who wins what's essentially an election about inequality. Is it, you know, the Trump sort of rhetoric, which is just playing on the division and getting people to blame Mexicans and others maybe for what's happening? Or can, you know, the likely Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton somehow come up with solutions to inequality? But I think that's the issue of the coming year. It's the issue of this election. And, you know, it's so visceral and so, I think, honest.
I don't think that it's actually about inequality. I think it's about change more broadly than that. And I think that what we really are seeing is a group of disaffected Americans who are responding to these outsider candidates in a way that they have not historically. The real question is whether they're going to actually show up and vote. But it's actually coming at a time when there is an opportunity, I think, for dramatic change. We saw the change in leadership in the Republican Party when it came to the Congress this year. We're going to see additional, I think, generational change in both parties over the course of the coming several years. And I think that the real question is whether there is one party that is able to translate this anger, this demand for dramatic change, into something healthy, or whether it turns into a kind of stray voltage effect within the election that isn't actually translated into either party.
Gene, what did we learn, if anything, about money? We're talking about a situation in which basically the grassroots overwhelms the elites. The elites are the ones with the money. There was a lot of talk before this campaign about how candidates with fundraising prowess, Scott Walker, gone from the race. Jeb Bush, shock and awe, he'd raised so much money, not doing well in the polls. Did we learn anything about the power of this populist movement with respect to money?
We learned that you can't buy an election, and that is very heartening, that small donors can still have a big influence. We also were reminded of a lesson that we knew before but forgot in all of the, you know, super PAC moments, and that is that donating to a candidate is the first vote. And so the candidates that can draw small donors can survive because that's real support. And the funny thing with Trump that people overlook is he talks about, you know, I don't want your money, I'm financing my own campaign. He's not. He's not. If you go back and look, because he's not buying TV ads, so he's not spending big, he actually has enough small donations, unsolicited, coming into his campaign that he's financing it with their money. So we have been reminded that the money primary does matter, and that is in the small donor, not necessarily the big donor.
Yeah, and it's part of the interesting paradox of Trump that this billionaire would serve as the most effective vehicle for this populist. This populist strain is something we've heard going back several cycles, certainly to Pat Buchanan, but that Trump is able to call out the donor class the way he has because he's been a member of it is kind of remarkable. Can I put another question on the table, though, that I'd love the answer to in the year ahead, which is the problem of Syria? I doubt we'll get that answer, but going back to what Ben was saying about the stress on Europe and the greater Middle East, making some progress towards the solution there seems to me...
I don't see any candidate really. I mean, there's talk on the Republican side about being more tough, but I don't think anyone's going to send in a large number of American troops. That's the only way you sort of quickly change and stabilize Syria. So I think you see more of the same awful, you know, the deaths, the refugee flows, and a stronger ISIS. Mm-hmm. Yes, they're losing ground in Iraq, but, you know, their message is resonating.
And Syria is a two-pronged question, Assad and ISIS.
The most interesting thing, I think, for both parties right now is what did you learn from the last 15 years? What are the lessons you took from these experiences when it comes to foreign and domestic policy? I think what you see on the Republican side is a number of candidates who have taken away certain things. It is no accident that Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, the two people who are most critical of the Iraq policy under the Bush administration, are leading in the polls currently on the Republican side. That says something significant. It's also a question of what Hillary Clinton learned for the last 15 years. We're going to find that out over the next year.
All right, we're going to have to end it there. Thanks to all of you. Happy New Year. Astronaut Scott Kelly joins us from the International Space Station. Commander Kelly, you first went into space in 1999. What's different now?
Well, my first flight was on just on the space shuttle. It was to the Hubble Space Telescope, and that was before we had the International Space Station. It wasn't a few years later before we launched the first people to the space station, the first human presence in space, which we've had for the last 15 years. You know, it's a much different experience now with this International Space Station and the international cooperation and all the research we have that go with it than what we were doing back in the 1990s and previously.
How about for you personally, though, being in space now relative to that very first time you went?
Well, you know, flying in space is a privilege, whether it's the first time or the fourth time. But, you know, obviously back then it was my first flight. It was 7 days long. And, you know, since then I've flown three times previous or subsequently durations of, you know, 13 days, 159 days. And now, you know, this flight will be close to a year. So they've been getting larger and larger each time. And I think if I fly a fifth time, it'll have to be to Mars to get that kind of duration that'll be required to keep up the trend.
Before we go any further, what room are you in there?
So I am in the U.S. Destiny Laboratory module, which is like the main module for the U.S. side of the space station. It's a combination of laboratory and sort of like the bridge of a ship. I guess you could describe it with a lot of the systems that are required to operate the space station are in here, as well as experiments.
And in case there are any conspiracy theorists out there, how would you prove to us that you're in zero gravity?
I would just do this for a while, and unless I was falling, that would be kind of hard to do.
NASA has put a call out for those who might want to be astronauts. What would you look for if you were on the hiring committee?
So I was on the hiring committee last time, and we picked a great group. And, you know, what we look for are people that are technically competent. You need a background in, you know, in the scientific field, whether it's as a scientist, an engineer, medical doctor, or, you know, a person that's in the military with some kind of technical background. And we want those people to have proven themselves in their current profession, being very high performers, but also people that get along well as part of a team, because this is a huge team effort, not just your crew members here on board, but also with all the folks you have to work with on the ground. You know, just a really a diverse group of people with, you know, skills that are very broad. We have a lot of systems here on board the space station, and we can't call a repairman when one of them breaks, so we have to be kind of generalists in a lot of ways.
Have you noticed any of the effects on space that you're there to look at and discover in yourself?
You know, a lot of the data we collect is stuff that has to be analyzed on the ground. For instance, we can't see, you know, bone loss ourselves. You know, that's something that, you know, we'll have to notice with imaging technology when I get back. But, you know, there are certain things we could see with regards to muscle mass, like the amount of muscle I've lost in my calf muscle because we don't walk up here is pretty significant. You know, some effects on my vision initially, although those have kind of leveled off and have been pretty consistent with what I had on my last flight. But we're also looking at, you know, the effects of this environment, the microgravity environment and the radiation environment on myself on a genetic level, how my DNA is affected. And that's using my brother as a control subject on the ground.
Is it still a thrill to look out the window?
Yeah, it's, you know, the Earth is a very beautiful place. It's thrilling to look at. You know, but like a lot of things, you know, if you see it often, it's not as thrilling as the first time you've seen it, but it still never fails to impress.
Have you been following the news from up there? I mean, have you watched, what do you think of the presidential campaign that's going on down here on Earth?
Yeah, so we have the news on pretty much all the time, unless we're watching something specific. And we have coverage about, you know, 50 minutes every hour. So I do follow it very closely, and I have to say it's been very interesting.
Commander Scott Kelly, thanks so much. That's it for us today. Thanks for watching. Until next week, for Face the Nation, I'm John Dickerson. Today's guests were Senator Bernie Sanders, Dr. Ben Carson, Stephen Colbert, and Commander Scott Kelly. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky-Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern, every Sunday.